Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriventfinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Meglund. You know that feeling of being nickel and dimed into poverty? Here's another way it can happen.
Very gradually over, you know, it's been now 4 or 5 years, they've shifted the price up, so 15 cents is completely typical, and now it's going to be 20 cents.
That's Glenn Fleischman with this week's Marketplace Money Inside quote. So what small cost does Glenn say is creeping upwards? Is it A, the price of a postcard stamp? One more example of the growing expense of world travel. Or are we talking about B, the cost of sending a text message? Prepare to be sent a bigger bill from your cell phone provider. Or is the price blowing up for C, a piece of Bazooka Joe bubblegum? Because it's getting more expensive to print those little comics. Only one answer is right. Find out which one on this week's Marketplace Money, up next from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. There's so much that's just ridiculous annoying about cell phones. The 99-year contract, the dead spots where you can only get like half a signal bar. And then there are the bills. Want to text me your thoughts on those? Maybe L8R? I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Big news for all you folks who wouldn't put down your cell phone even if a rogue satellite was about to fall on your head. This week, three major carriers announced an all-you-can-talk calling plan, $99.99 a month for unlimited gabbing. Verizon, T-Mobile, and AT&T are offering the service. Sprint's been testing a similar plan. If you've ever used more than your monthly allotted minutes, you know how those extra charges can add up. But there's another thing you can do with your phone that's getting people into money trouble these days. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli says if you're all thumbs, you better watch the meter.
Doug Patterson studies the family's cell phone bills carefully. He says it took a while for his daughter to catch on to text messaging.
We started off at the beginning of 2006 with her doing 8 text messages in January.
These days, she sends well over 2,000 every month.
Yeah, and all times of day and night. You know, even in an hour of television with all the family there, she can do 5 or 6 messages.
Anyone who gives their kid a phone has probably had a freak-out moment when the bill comes with pages of extra charges. Enter flat-rate messaging plans. If you carry a cell phone without one these days, you'd do so at your own peril. Industry analyst Glenn Fleischman says even though the cost of technology usually goes down the more people use it, as we've gotten more addicted to texting, text message rates have been climbing.
Very gradually over, you know, it's been now 4 or 5 years, they've shifted the price up. So 15 cents is completely typical. And now it's going to be 20 cents from AT&T if you're not a subscriber with a plan.
And that's the point. Carriers are raising the per-message cost to entice you to sign up for one of those plans. You can get one for as little as $5 a month, but generally that pays for only a few hundred messages. That's not going to cut it if you've got a thumb-happy person in the house. But be prepared. A flat-rate, all-you-can-text family plan will slap at least an extra $15 more to your monthly phone bill. Though some of us are resigned to these expenses, lately there have been rumblings on some blogs about the high price of text messaging, especially because the service costs the mobile carriers virtually nothing.
There is a cost in terms of the server and the hardware and the software, but in terms of the network and the phone, no, it's built in.
That's Ian Gillett. He studies the mobile phone industry for a living. He says cell carriers want you to love text messaging because it's like training wheels for other things you can do with your phone, things that make the carriers even more money.
You start thinking about buying ringtones, and then you buy games, and then you use the internet because you're using the keyboard or using the phone for things other than voice.
a buck or two here for a special ringtone for your boyfriend, one for your best friend, then for the new boyfriend, then your new best friend, $4, $5, $6 for the latest game, Googling whatever. Now, you could ask the carrier to turn off these services, but that's almost more complicated than figuring out which plan to buy. You could also cap costs by opting for a prepaid phone, or you can appease the texting teenager in your life by buying one of those devices that only lets you text an instant message. Ralph Harita makes one of them. It's called a Zip-It. He thinks he's got a good deal.
A $5 a month plan for 3,000 messages.
Thing is, the Zip-It will cost you $149, and you need to be near a Wi-Fi hotspot for it to work. Industry analyst Ian Gillett says that's not the only downside.
The problem is the kids want the full phone.
No matter how you cut it, modern communications comes with the price that keeps rising. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
Need a quick pick-me-up? I have three words for you. Tax, rebate, checks. But judging from the email we've been getting, there's still a lot of confusion about them. So we have decided to go straight to the source. The tax man himself. Or should we say, a tax man. Frank Keith is a spokesman for the IRS, and he's agreed to answer your questions about the tax refunds. Hi, Frank.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, and thanks for joining us. Let's go ahead to our first caller.
Hi, my name's Gary in Boise, Idaho. I haven't heard whether the upcoming stimulus checks will be tax-free or not. Do you have any idea? Thank you.
All right, well, there you go, Frank. This is a very common question, whether taxes will actually be taken out of what's a tax rebate.
Well, the rebate's not taxable, so you wouldn't report it next year on your tax return. It's also important to know that the rebate won't affect any federal benefits programs, such as Social Security or veterans benefits that the taxpayer might be receiving.
All right. Well, let's hear another question about taxes on the tax rebate.
Hi, this is Graham from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. I heard that the rebate that we were getting is just in advance on our 2008 tax return. Is that true?
I think there's a lot of confusion because people are afraid that their refund check next year is going to be reduced dollar for dollar by the amount of this stimulus payment they're getting.
Right.
And that's simply not the case. The amount of the check that they get this year won't reduce in any way the refund they'll be entitled to next year.
All right, let's go to caller number three. And this has to do with what happens if you didn't make any money last year.
My name is Chan, and I live in Ocoee, Florida. My parents are receiving Social Security and do not file taxes. Should they have filed a 2007 tax return in order to receive the tax rebate?
Well, I'm going to make an assumption that his parents receive over $3,000 a year in Social Security.
Okay.
And since that's likely to be the case, they absolutely should file a 2007 tax return because they would also be entitled to a rebate, even though they don't normally file and even though they don't normally pay any taxes. The similar situation exists for people who receive certain veterans benefits. As long as they have at least $3,000 of veterans benefits, they also will qualify.
All right. You mentioned the $3,000 figure, and we have another question about that one.
Hi, this is Patty from Dayton, Ohio. I'm confused by the term married couples. Do stay-at-home parents earning less than the minimum $3,000 factor into these rebates?
Okay, you have a married couple that you would assume would be eligible for the $1,200 rebate, but one of them is a stay-at-home parent. So for the household, as long as they're above the $3,000 threshold, they're going to get a check?
That's correct. The rules apply on a joint return. You would combine the income. So, for instance, the $3,000 qualifying income limitation, that would be the total on the return. It could be earned by the husband, the wife, or some combination.
Okay. And one final question from Mark in Riverton, Connecticut. The full tax rebate applies to couples with incomes under $150,000. Can you tell him what line on the 1040 form the income is referring to? From what I understand, this is adjusted gross income. Where do you find that?
It's the very, very bottom number on the front page of the tax return.
Well, Frank Keith, thanks so much for coming in and helping to clarify this tax rebate that everyone's so excited about.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Frank Keith is a spokesman for the Internal Revenue Service. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, how about we tick off the standard financial headlines these days?
Okay.
Stock market is tanking.
Yeah.
The economy may be sinking into recession.
Yep.
The Fed is trying to stave off a downturn by slashing interest rates.
And Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, he says, I'll cut rates some more if I have to.
That's right. But, Chris, I noticed one thing is kind of missing from the headlines. What happened to inflation fears? I mean, that's all we heard about for months from the Fed.
I know, it's true. Inflation really does seem to be, it's on the back burner. But if you ask me, Tess, it shouldn't be. I mean, the latest import price numbers, they show higher prices, and that puts upward pressure on domestic prices. And the consumer price index, it's running well above the 1% to 2% Fed target range. So here's the straight story. Inflation could go higher, or it could go lower. But one thing's for sure, it pays for everyone to protect their portfolio from the risk of rising prices.
So if we have rising prices and yet we're cutting interest rates, where does that leave us?
Stagflation.
Uh-oh.
That dreaded term from the 1970s,
yeah.
Where you have higher than expected inflation and slower than expected economic growth. Now, I don't think we're going back to the 1970s. And to some extent, it's sort of like stagflation light. Inflation running at 5 to 6%. We're not talking double-digit inflation. But, you know, 5 to 6% inflation rate. That's significant. It's a risk that's out there.
So what can we do to protect ourselves against inflation?
I think there's a couple things that we can do. And, you know, I'm not saying run out there and panic, but there's a couple investments that I like.
Okay.
One is, and you've heard this, load up on cash or increase your cash holdings, short-term treasury bills, money market mutual funds. Because if inflation does come about, these short-term instruments, they participate in those higher interest rates. So you don't fall behind. And there's another advantage. At some point, we know the economy turns around. At some point, there are genuine buying opportunities.
Right.
And if you have cash, you can take advantage of them. Another thing that you can do, I-bonds, which are savings bonds that protect you against inflation because it adjusts to the consumer price index,
mm-hmm.
or TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, which do the same thing. Now, the only thing about TIPS, just put them in your IRA or your 401k, 403b, whatever sort of retirement savings plan you have. Those are three really good ways to protect yourself against inflation.
One other thing that you kind of hear about when we're in this kind of situation,
yeah.
People will actually start talking about investing in commodities, and specifically gold and platinum and other precious metals. Should we be buying those things?
You know, I've been wrong about precious metals for the past 2-3 years because gold keeps climbing higher. Platinum, I saw the other day at record prices.
Right.
I mean, the problem that I have is they cost you money and it's a real speculation. So if you want to own that, there's actually a very good new way to do that, and that is through ETFs.
Oh, exchange traded fund. Okay.
That's a really good way for the individual investor to expose themselves to the precious metal. Again, with gold over $900 an ounce, I go, how can it keep going? But if you want to protect your portfolio with a little bit of precious metals, I'd go the ETF route. I think that's a good way for the individual in today's market.
All right. A little inflation advice from our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, if you need to save more for retirement, some financial planners are happy to play head games with you.
Most people are very goal-oriented. Once they see that the way you play this game is to have more, they get focused on it.
And we figure out how to repair your credit report without going and making things even worse. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund, and it is America Saves Week this coming week. Get out the party hats and streamers, as long as they're on sale. The biggest advice from the pros is to make saving automatic. Set up your accounts so some money goes right into rainy day and retirement funds. You won't miss it because you never see it in your paycheck. Why don't more people do this already? It is a question that drives financial planners crazy. So some are trying a little armchair psychology. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli says they're reframing the whole idea of saving for retirement.
Misplaced worry and a sense of helplessness often stop people from moving on retirement saving. Seemingly daunting numbers can freeze them into inaction. But financial planners say if they can show clients the good outcomes within reach, that changes things, which is why Oregon planner Peter Toll says a lot of planning starts off on a very wrong foot.
The focus always tends to be on the numbers. And so we wind up being distracted and driven by the numbers, when in fact the numbers have to be remembered as only a vehicle to reaching what you're looking for.
So Toll's reframing method flips the focus away from numbers.
It's a backwards process. Instead of saying, okay, if you can have $50,000 a year or $100,000 a year to live on, what would you like to do with it? The backwards process is, let's figure out what you want to do and then figure out if you can afford it.
That way, people start saving for a specific thing, a new life, which makes it more doable and less overwhelming. Betta D'Angelo is a planner in North Carolina. She says her clients often can't see beyond today's bills enough to start saving. They may know some cost cutting's in order, but they can't work out how to get there. So she reorients them toward retirement with a small trick, taking the focus completely off that goal to start.
If I feel there's a need for rigorous cost cutting, I find a short-term goal that I know they can achieve. It's really just getting people refocused on a positive short-term goal. That really is the way you do it.
Once a few bills get paid, a retirement fund can start. Then D'Angelo holds clients' attention with monthly statements showing their assets growing.
And most people are very goal-oriented. Once they see that the way you play this game is to have more, they get focused on it.
Focused to the point where clients often start upping retirement contributions on their own. Suburban Boston planner Matthew Schutt is a pioneer of the reframing approach. He advises getting clients to think about today's purchases differently, especially big ones. Schutt uses the example of a new car where you can finance the luxury model for $600 a month or get a more basic model.
What if I could say, for that same $600 a month, I can get the basic edition at $400 a month, and I can pre-purchase a half a year of retirement with that other $200 a month?
This approach has two benefits. It can kickstart saving and establish the mental budgeting that keeps spending down, leaving even more to save. That's because every needless expenditure gets reframed as a sort of theft from your future self. Schutt says it makes you think twice about the true cost of living large.
It gives you a way that you can see there in front of you and you can balance out when you make those decisions. You know, do I want the 3-bedroom house, the 4-bedroom house, or the 5-bedroom house?
So here are the take-home messages. First, think of today's spending curbs not as a sacrifice, but as a down payment on your own future freedom. Second, pay off bills in small steps if you must, whatever it takes to start the saving cycle. And finally, put big, scary future retirement numbers out of your mind. You don't need $500,000 or $1 million today. Focus only on what you need to save now. All three ways of reframing retirement thinking have this advantage. They'll launch you on a path where the rest, over time, often takes care of itself. For Marketplace Money, I'm Steve Tripoli.
You know, it seems like every week we hear about another bank stumbling on new losses from the subprime mess. This week, the British government announced it's going to temporarily take over Northern Rock because nobody else wants to save that lender. Credit Suisse and Barclays reported more massive write-downs. Same thing happened last week with UBS. What it all means to you is that the credit crunch is far from over. You're going to need great scores to borrow anything from banks these days. And we're noticing there's no shortage of folks who want to help you.
Zoom Credit specializes in credit repair and debt consolidation, too.
Well, before you pick up the phone, we've brought in consumer advocate Ed Mirzwinski. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, we're doing all right. We've noticed recently that there are a whole lot of these credit repair ads that seem to be flourishing on billboards, on the radio stations. Are we indeed seeing more than ever?
You know, it's absolutely true. The credit doctors come out when the economy goes bad. When people need money, they need better credit reports, and the credit doctors make promises that aren't true that they can fix your credit report, and they make a lot of money, even though what they do is absolutely illegal.
Do any of these credit doctors have the equivalent of an MD in their field?
No, we call them credit repair doctors or credit doctors for short because they claim they can doctor your credit.
What do these agencies promise that they will do? I mean, what's the process that they say they're going to take you through?
The basic form of credit repair is bombardment of the credit bureau with phone calls and letters, hoping that multiple complaints, multiple investigations will overwhelm the credit bureau computers, overwhelm the credit bureau customer service staff. But the thing is, credit bureaus are smart enough to know that if they get 100 letters from one consumer, it's probably coming from a credit doctor who's trying to trick them into changing the consumer's file.
And what are they charging for that?
Well, a credit doctor might charge $300 per application to fix your credit, or they might charge a monthly fee of $20 or so to provide continuing credit doctor services.
What else do they say that they can do for you?
They started offering people new Social Security numbers. Now, of course, it's very difficult to get a new Social Security number, but it's not so hard to get a new business type of Social Security number that is often used by the IRS for either non-residents or for business applications. And then what would happen is you would get this new form of a Social Security number. It has the same number of digits, known as a taxpayer identification number, and you would associate your new accounts with that number, and the credit doctor would tell you that all your old information won't appear when they generate your credit report based on this new TIN.
Well, should you trust any of these credit repair agencies?
Absolutely not. If you can't pay your bills, find a legitimate consumer credit counseling office. Don't go to any form of credit repair company.
If you've already signed up with one of these outfits, is it possible to get out?
Absolutely. You want to complain to your state attorney general, and you want to complain to the local Better Business Bureau if you believe that a credit doctor has taken your money and is continuing to take your money.
All right. Ed Mierzwinski is the Consumer Program Director with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us on.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
It's time again for Getting Personal, when we answer your money questions. With me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go straight to the phones. Our first caller is John from Calumet, Michigan. Hi, John.
Hi.
So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, my grandmother passed away about a year ago, and I've been named as personal representative in her will. She owes money still to the nursing home that she was in. There is no cash left in the estate, but we still have her house. Now, the house is sitting here, and it looks like it could take a long time to sell it the way the market is right now. I'm wondering if it's possible for the estate to take out something like a reverse mortgage so that I can pay these bills and get the creditors off my back and maybe put some money back into the house to make it a little more sellable.
Good question. I assume the house is paid off?
Yes.
Okay. Chris?
Okay, you would not be able to take out a reverse mortgage. You need to be 62 years old or older. Here's my main advice. I would consult with an estate attorney, because this is an area where you just want to protect yourself, protect your family. You're going to sell the house, and then the estate will be responsible for paying off the debt to the nursing home.
Okay.
What if they're not able to sell the house for quite a while? Does this debt just sit there, this $10,000 to the nursing home?
Yeah.
Can they come after John at all?
They come after the estate. And the one thing that all estate planning attorneys will tell you is for John not to pay off the debt himself.
But just because he's been named the family representative doesn't mean that the nursing home can ask him to pay it.
That's correct.
Okay.
If there are other family members, your responsibility is to consult with them too.
Okay.
Does that help you out?
Yeah, I guess the bottom line is patience.
Patience plus a consultation.
Right.
It'll be money well worth spent.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
All right.
Bye-bye. Well, sometimes it's not your finances you're worried about, it's someone else's. But either way, we can help you figure it all out. Visit our website, we're at marketplace.org, click on the Getting Personal link, or give us a call at 1-877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, we wanted to do a quick follow-up to a caller who we had on last week's show. And this is the woman who was named as a beneficiary in her sister's life insurance settlement. And she thought that that probably wasn't what her sister intended, that she would have wanted this money to go to her kids. But Deborah was named as the beneficiary. And so we suggested that she could use that money, perhaps open a 529 plan for the kids, open some sort of trustee account. But we got a lot of listeners who wrote in and suggested an alternative answer. You wanted to address that.
Yes, it was very good. And I want to thank all those listeners, such as Thomas in Rochester, who sent us very thoughtful emails. And like, for example, what Thomas said, he's assuming that the sister had not received the money yet. And I believe that was our conversation, right. And that she can declaim the property. It can revert back to the estate of the family.
And then it can be just distributed like the rest of
exactly.
The estate. And what Thomas mentioned is that legally, if Deborah disclaims the proceeds,
correct.
She is treated as though she died before her sister did. And so then the policy proceeds then are just paid right back to the sister's estate. So that's another option.
And that's why you need a lawyer, just to make sure that you do the steps right.
Right. All right, let's move on. We've got another email from Michelle in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And she and her husband are in their 20s. They moved recently from San Diego to Milwaukee. But their San Diego home, they weren't able to sell before they moved.
It's
been on the market for over a year now. And so now they have two interest-only mortgages. Both are at a fixed rate. But here's the problem. Guess what I'm going
to
say?
Has something to do with the value of that home in San Diego?
Oh, my friend, you are so smart. Yes, the value of their San Diego house is dropping like a stone. And they are considering foreclosure, which we never, ever like to hear on the show.
Okay.
The realtor wants them to do a short sale, which is where you make a deal with the bank and you sell the house for less than what you bought it for. And the bank says, OK, we're going to let you do that.
Yep.
Michelle doesn't think that they qualify for a short sale because they are not in any sort of economic hardship situation. They can pay both these mortgages.
Yeah.
So what are their options here? She says they're leaning toward foreclosure. But as I said, we never like to hear that as an option.
Never like to hear it. And just as a more of an aside, but we do live in the era of the credit score.
Right.
And if you do a short sale, it typically has an impact on your credit score. But foreclosure has a much bigger impact on your credit score.
So if you are absolutely insisting on getting rid of the house, then it's better to try to do a short sale than
it is better to try and do a short sale. And remember, you're negotiating with the loss mitigation department at your lender.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting a lot of phone calls these days. So it typically pays to have a real estate lawyer, someone who has expertise, knows how to negotiate with a loss mitigation department to try and strike the deal for you. I also have to say that if you're able to make both payments, why not think about renting the house in San Diego? You know, markets fluctuate.
Right.
And to me, that seems preferable than doing the possibility of a short sale, which we think they're not going to be able to do, or going through foreclosure.
Do you think that she's right that given the fact that they are not in an economic hardship situation, that a bank is going to be hesitant to do a short sale with them?
Banks are under a lot of pressure to do short sales with people who are in economic hardship. So I can't see that the bank is going to be willing to strike a deal.
All right. Well, if you are going through some mortgage mayhem, you are not alone. Do give us a call. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we are answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link and stay tuned for more of Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You may have heard about thieves looting houses for copper. With demand on the rise, the wiring in your house might be worth more than your sound system. But that's not the only expensive commodity prompting thievery. Now we're hearing about folks being robbed of timber. In Kentucky, lawmakers are considering a couple of bills that would make it a felony to chop down someone's trees. Now, you can't exactly put the forest in a safe, but to protect any other valuable property, we know just the fella. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we get a locksmith to open up.
I make probably 10, 20,000 keys a year. A lot. Hi, my name is Guy, and I am one of the owners and manager of SOS Locksmith and Advanced Security Systems in New York City. When most people think of a locksmith, they probably think about losing their keys or forgetting their keys in the car. What was really a shock to me was how much work we do. We install doors, we fix glass. When doors fall off, we put them back on their hinges. We deal with safes, we deal with ironwork, gates, welding. The people that get locked out and losing keys is really a very small fraction of the actual work that's performed here. It's a family business. It's been here for about 35, 36 years. Since I was a kid, I used to cut keys, and 12 years ago, I started coming around here more often. I kind of liked it, so I've been here ever since. The favorite thing about this job is there's constantly new people, constantly going to different places. We see the best of both worlds. We see when people move into their apartments and they need to change their locks and their hardware just for safety's sake. And then we see, you know, when a boyfriend and a girlfriend break up or somebody gets divorced and they need to change their locks. The most bizarre thing was probably about once, twice a year, people in the bedroom lock themselves with a handcuff and they lose the key, or the key's too far for them to reach. On the other end of the spectrum, though, we've opened apartment doors where there's dead people. So, we've seen everything. My salary is approximately $100,000. An average locksmith salary, it's probably anywhere between $40,000 to $60,000 a year. Then you have people that provide emergency services. Technicians that work at night will make a substantial amount more, probably double, if the company has enough work to provide. I think one of the great things about this type of business, I would never have to worry about job security. Just like everybody has milk in their refrigerator and water to drink, everybody has a key. Even though we deal with a lot of electronic and keyless products and wireless products, there's millions and billions, and I could even say trillions of keys in this country. Every year, on a consistent level, we sell more and more deadbolts, and we install more locks for people. There will never be any worry in terms of job security. Oh boy, you're going to embarrass me now. Did I ever lock myself out of anywhere? Yes, I did. Actually, when I moved into my new apartment, when I was bringing up boxes, I did slam the door behind me. I called one of my friends, and they came and they helped me open the door. It was very cheap. Yes, everybody laughed. My wife laughed, my employees laughed, and it was a pretty good laugh here for about a month.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Sally Herships.
Have a great day.
Hey, thanks, man. You too. All right, coming up, we already talked about the government's tax rebates, but you do know, don't you, that it is tax payment time? We get the latest advice on filing without fear.
Now, I know one lawyer, he, instead of giving cash at the church, he would actually put a note in the plate, and they would bill him so that he has receipts.
You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. You'd think that 232 years into this grand democratic experiment of ours, America would have figured out a way to make taxes consistent and reasonable. But no. Each year, Congress and the IRS make all kinds of new laws and rules that change everything around and drive us all crazy as we try to figure out what's old and what's new and what's up. Well, joining us again, as he did at this time last year, is the Wall Street Journal's tax columnist, Tom Herman. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tess. Good to be with you.
Let's talk about 2007 first. That's obviously what folks are most worried about right now. What are some of the big changes that they need to look out for as they prepare their returns?
Well, Tess, there's some good news. Three major deductions that were on last year's return were very hard to find because Congress didn't make the law clear until very late the prior year after the IRS's forms had gone to press. This year, those deductions are very easy to find, and they're important ones. One of the deductions is you have a choice of whether to deduct your income taxes at the state and local level or your sales taxes. People in states with no income taxes, such as Florida or Texas or Washington State, find this very, very important. This is a big deduction for them. Another deduction is the higher education deduction. Essentially, it allows you to decrease your income subject to tax by up to $4,000, and this is for tuition and fees, not just tuition. These have to be expenses for a student who's enrolled in an eligible education institution, and it can be either you, or it could be your spouse, or it could be a dependent. And these are tuition and fees that are required for enrollment or attending an eligible post-secondary educational institution. But they don't include personal expenses or family expenses, such as room and board. And the third one is a deduction for elementary and secondary school teachers. This was a deduction of as much as $250 a year for out-of-pocket classroom supply costs, such as books or computer equipment. There was no clearly marked line on the form last year because, again, Congress was so late in changing the law. This year, it is clearly marked.
All right. So those are some deductions to look out for if you weren't aware of them last year or didn't know where to find them on your tax forms. I also remember that for 2007, isn't it getting a little harder to prove your charitable deductions? You have to have a little more proof than you used to.
Yes, you do. You need proof of a charitable donation if you want to deduct it, no matter how big the deduction is. So if you dropped $50 into the church plate last year, but you don't have any receipts, you're not supposed to deduct it this year unless you have some kind of proof. Now, I know one lawyer in Los Angeles who actually changed the way he gives. He, instead of giving cash at the church, he would actually put a note in the plate and they would bill him so that he has receipts for all of his donations and therefore he can deduct those donations.
All right. And there's also a new option for older taxpayers in terms of donating money from their IRAs.
That's right. That provision expired at the end of last year. I'm getting a lot of email about that. The law says that you could deduct up to $100,000 from your IRA directly to a qualified charity, and you would not have to pay any taxes on that transfer. You couldn't take it out of the IRA and then donate it. You had to make the transfer directly from the IRA to charity. That transfer would qualify for your minimum required distributions from your IRA. So that appealed to a lot of people. And I've heard from many charities. They say they've gotten millions of dollars in additional gifts because that provision existed.
Okay, and that's something that you would have had to have completed the transaction by December 31st then.
That's right. There is one thing you still can do for last year to cut your taxes. That is, you could fund your old IRA. You could put in the contribution limits and still deduct that up to April 15th. But other than that, I can't think of anything you can do now to cut your taxes for last year.
Well, let's go to the housing situation and tell us about the home sale exclusion for widows and widowers. I know you've written about this.
There's a new law that took effect at the beginning of this year, and it helps a lot of people whose spouse died and who can't or don't want to sell their home right away. So under the old law, what would sometimes happen is someone's spouse would die late in the year. You could file married, filing jointly for that year, but not for the following year.
Hmm.
The new law says that you can still get that full $500,000 exclusion if the widow or widower sells the house within 2 years of the date of death. And in many cases, it will mean that the widow or widower who sells will not have to pay any capital gains tax on the sale of the home as long as they sell it within 2 years.
We got a question from a listener recently who has heard the phrase zero capital gains. Tell us about this. I understand it applies to lower income investors, right?
That's right. And I've gotten a lot of questions from readers, too. It's confusing. Here's how it works. In most cases, when you sell stocks or bonds or mutual fund shares, the top long-term capital gains rate is 15%. That's if you've owned the stock or mutual fund for more than a year. But in 2008, there is a rate of zero for people whose incomes put them in the two lowest ordinary income brackets. Those are the 10 and 15% brackets. So if your income falls into those brackets, including your capital gains, the capital gains tax rate is zero in 2008.
And finally, if you were hoping to shield some of your income by giving it to your young kiddies, a little too late to avoid the kiddie tax. Tell us about this.
Congress has expanded this so-called kiddie tax. It's a strange name. Basically, the kiddie tax in English means certain income is taxed at the parents' higher rate instead of the kids' lower rate. The kiddie tax age has been moved up over the years. The idea of moving it up again, the reason Congress did it, was because of that zero capital gains rate in 2008. Congress wanted to make sure that wealthy parents couldn't move a lot of stocks and bonds and mutual fund shares to their kids, have the kids sell them in 2008, and then pay no tax. So now the ages have been moved up, and you can't do that, as several people had hoped they would be able to do for 2008.
All right. Tom Herman is the tax columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for coming back and helping us out with 2007.
My pleasure, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
A supreme screw-up brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, ERISA. It stands for Employee Retirement Income Security Act. Among other things, this law lets you sue if something in your retirement plan goes awry. That's what James LaRue did after he asked his 401k managers to move his money into safer investments. They didn't do it. And LaRue wound up losing $150,000. Whoops! This week, the Supreme Court unanimously decided that, under ERISA, individual investors can sue their fund managers for such blunders. Now the managers will have to invest in a team of lawyers.
We're back again with Getting Personal, and as always, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, we've got an email from Marilyn in Rochester, Minnesota. She and her husband are retired, and Chris, they have no debt.
That's wonderful. That's great.
They do use credit cards, but she says that they are paid on the day the bill arrives.
Excellent.
Wonderful. But they recently discovered something. Their insurance rates are higher because their credit score is apparently not optimal.
Okay. So here are people doing everything right financially.
Exactly.
Right. And they get penalized for it.
Don't they call these people deadbeats
yes.
in the credit card
Absolutely.
Industry? You pay your bill on time every month, and you're a deadbeat.
That's right.
Great. I will ask you the exact question that Marilyn sent us. How ridiculous is
this? It's absolutely ridiculous. You know, a lot of this credit scoring stuff has turned out to be bad.
Yeah.
You know, I'm hoping there's some changes that come about. But for right now, this is the world that we're living in. And really, for someone like Marilyn, the main piece of advice would be, and this is crazy, but this is the main piece of advice. Okay, so you're paying off your credit card bills. Mm-hmm. So you do have a history there. So that does show up at a good credit score. So then you take out a small installment loan. I don't know. What are you going to buy? A flat panel screen TV or something like that. And then you pay that off over a period of time. You just meet the bills regularly. You don't take out a big one, but a small installment plan. And that will boost your credit scores.
Is this something where they could potentially call up the insurance company and explain this?
I would. Yeah. I would. I'd say, you know, what's going on? And the other thing to do is shop around. I mean, not all insurance companies use it. Other insurance companies use different standards. They might use a different credit score number. I mean, you never know, and I don't know what insurance company it is. So shop around, open up a new account. And basically, if you're fuming and you're saying this is ridiculous, you're absolutely right, and I'm in your camp, unfortunately.
And let's hope that at some point this system rewards people who are being responsible with their credit.
That's right. And I actually think we are going to move more toward that world, that I think the system that evolved is a system that, in the end, people ended up borrowing too much.
Mm-hmm.
And in an odd way, you're rewarding people for borrowing more. And that is a fundamental flaw in that whole system.
All right. Well, from the ridiculous to the sublime, we welcome all of your questions. Hopefully, we'll be able to give you some tactics if you feel that credit card companies are charging after you. Do visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, our next caller is Mark, and he's in Noblesville, Indiana. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
What do you do there in Noblesville?
I'm an optometrist and eye doctor.
Oh, terrific. Well, hopefully we'll give you some 2020 advice here today. I'm sure
you've
never
heard
that
one before.
Right.
All right. Well, tell us what your question is for Chris today.
Well, my question is, it's kind of a two-part. I was considering Roth IRAs, especially custodial Roth IRA for my 16-year-old daughter as a college savings plan, as well as my little boy who doesn't have an income. But I thought instead of putting money, I guess, towards a 529 or a Coverdell, I wonder if I just put it in my Roth IRA, if he decides to not go to school or gets a scholarship or something, then I've got it for my retirement. You know, I didn't know if there's any pitfalls into that thinking.
Interesting. Well, Chris, we generally talk a lot about 529 plans as the best way to save for college. What do you think of this idea?
Okay, a couple of points. Let's focus for the moment on the 16-year-old daughter and thinking of the Roth IRA as a college savings plan. Mm-hmm. It's not a terrible idea. It's just not a great way for her to be saving for college. What it is a great thing to do is, I assume she's earning income, and so
she is.
You know, if you set up a Roth IRA for her and you just treat it as long-term savings, it's not going to hurt her in terms of financial aid, and then she can withdraw the earnings to pay for qualified educational expenses without paying the 10% penalty.
Mark, have you done any savings for her college yet?
Not much. And that's the thing, is because I'm a kind of a late bloomer. This is a second career. And so retirement had been on hold, and retirement actually has to come first. So, you know, what I understand, that should come first,
right,
before savings for college. You know?
And what about for the younger son?
Now, for the younger son, I use a different calculation. First of all, I liked what you said, Mark. Take care of yourself first. So absolutely, your retirement. For him, at this point in time, I don't think anything beats the 529 college savings plan, because you put the money in and then it's withdrawn tax-free and has minimal implications for the financial aid formula. So it is right now a very good college savings vehicle, plus aunts, relatives, they can all chip in. And so even sometimes now people are doing, they're saying, look, around the holiday season, you know, instead of buying a $25 gift, put the $25 into the 529. And it doesn't sound like that's much, but if you have a young son or a young daughter, it can add up over a period of time.
What if he decides to become a surf instructor instead and college is not in his plan? What happens to that 529 money?
Yeah, what does happen to the 529 money?
Well, then what you do is you transfer it to yourself or to, you know, somebody else in your family who decides they want to go on and continue their education. Or you could pay taxes and the 10% penalty on it. But usually what people do is they transfer it to another family member who is then going to use it. And by the way, there is no age restriction on a 529 plan.
So, Mark, you could use it for yourself and have a third career.
Exactly.
Well, either that or tell my wife that we got a plan on another kid as a backup plan, huh? For the 529.
I'll leave that between you two.
Yeah. All right.
All right. So does that help you out, Mark?
It sure does. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm,
you bet. Bye.
Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. And Chris, I think you've given folks a lot of terrific advice there online. So do visit our website. It's at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link, and you can also call us, of course. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Once a month, we kick back and let you say your piece about our show. Yes, it's time for some listener letters. The first concerns one of our Straight Story segments, in which Chris Farrell railed against a recent Supreme Court decision. That ruling made it tough for investors to sue third parties, like accountants, who help companies commit fraud. Think Enron. Listener Robert Singleton of Wadsworth, Ohio, was none too pleased with the court's decision.
My take on limiting lawsuits by investors is this. If you ever decide to rob a bank, make sure you're the driver. You drive the robbers to the bank, but you do not go in. You wait in the car. And when the robbers come back to the car, you drive them away. Since you only drove the car and didn't participate in the actual robbery, you must be innocent.
On our Getting Personal segment a few weeks back, Chris and I spoke to a young lady who'd taken out some college loans. Her mother co-signed for them, but was worried about getting stuck with the payments if her daughter passed away. So mom wanted her to take out a life insurance policy. We said it was a legit concern, even if it seemed a bit cold. Many of you wrote in to say we were the cold ones. Betty Downer listens to us in Indianapolis.
I felt for the mother, probably about my age or younger, and I thought her request was more than reasonable, and the characterization of cold was unfortunate. I realize that young people believe they will live forever, but the reality is that sometimes they don't. I know a family that lost a college-age son in a traffic accident, and yes, they had to pay off his loans.
Earlier this month, we told you about coupons the government is handing out. You use them to buy a converter box so your old TV can receive digital broadcast signals. But listener Dan Else of Washington, D.C. warns those boxes aren't widely available yet, and by the time you find one, the coupons could be expired. So keep an eye on that expiration date, and thanks for the heads up, Dan. And finally, we heard from Ken Stevens in Fort Pierce, Florida. He noticed Chris likes to sing the praises of an organization called SCORE. It gives free advice to entrepreneurs looking to open their own small businesses.
And I agree, SCORE is a great resource. But you fail consistently to mention the Small Business Development Center, SBDC, which does an equally great job in providing the same kind of assistance to small businesses, and again, at no cost.
Ken is indeed correct. You can learn more about these guys at asbdc-us.org. Or if that's too many random letters to remember, we've got a link to both organizations on our website. It's marketplace.org. That also happens to be where you can send us your letters. Just look for the link that says contact. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, why would a struggling actor suddenly decide to spend money on Arabic classes?
He just suddenly said to me, "Get ready for it. You're going to play terrorist for the rest of your life."
Cue the 24 countdown clock. If you're counting down until our next show, we're looking for your ideas about how to fix America's struggling economy. Head to marketplace.org and click on Your Economy to share your thoughts. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Janae Darden, James Richter, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.